Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 205 of the series covers a Russian struggle thread, two disabled men in the Free State, and a surge in surveyors. Sprinkled with tales of Hoffman. That would be Johannes Hoffman, commonly known as C.S. Hoffman, the first president of the Orange Free State, who signed the Bloemfontein Convention with the British in February 1854. Regarded as a shrewd and able merchant, he'd been disabled in an accident, but that didn't stop Hoffman from wielding political power. He was also a fundamentalist Voortrekker, hardcore. Hoffman was one of the representatives of the Smithfield district in the Orange River sovereignty during the negotiations between the Boers and the British. Both Hoffman and his state secretary, Jacobus Groenendael, were disabled, and the government quickly gained the nickname the Crippled Government, which is not only wicked, but wouldn't fly in today's equitable lexicon. Groenendael had been born in Holland and travelled to South Africa as a teacher in 1849. Hoffman was a friend of Mashweshwe of the Basutu, conciliatory towards the Griqua, who lived in the Transvaal, and pretty distrustful of Pretorius's more militant Boers. His friendships with black and coloured people living around the Free State caused deep mistrust amongst his fellow Boers. Hoffman's term in office was also short-lived, just under 1 year, thus the crippled government epithet. As a gesture of good faith, Hoffman had given a present of a keg of gunpowder to King Mashweshwe. His fellow burghers found this an unwise move, over-friendly and potentially dangerous for the survival of the new state. Relations between the Boers and the Basutu were less than cordial, with the border dispute unresolved. What sealed Hoffman's fate, however, was not the gift itself so much as the fact that he tried to hide his actions from the Volksraad and the Orange Free State Parliament. Hoffman was also on record saying he'd have preferred the British to have remained in the Free State, which went against the sentiment of some of the more extreme Trekkers. He saw the British as stabilisers, but once it was clear that Governor George Grey was in no mood to get involved in any activities to the north of the Orange, he shouldered what was to be a considerable burden of founding a new country. As the Sand River Convention had done for the Transvaalers, the Bloemfontein Convention granted the Free State as a free hand, the British going further in renouncing any alliance whatever with any native chief or tribes northward of the Orange River, with the exception of the Griqua chief Captain Adam Cook. It was the last bit that was going to become a bit of a problem for the Free Staters. The exception turns into the rule, or in this case, the unruly. Adam Cook was intensely independent and brooked no interference from the Boers. Because the British had his back and he lived on excellent grazing territory, many Boers felt Cook needed to be brought down a peg or two. As disappointed British settlers trundled back south across the border in 1854, a klein trek, if you like, Hoffman surveyed his new country. It had three cannon, a few basic buildings, and furniture left behind by the departing Brits. Some tables, chairs, desks, shelves, inkstands, green baize, and a couple of safes. "Freely sacrificed in the cause of peace," as the Times of London noted sarcastically. The departure of the British created a kind of political vacuum after 1854, a tabula rasa, as historian Timothy Keegan calls it, for the use of local ruling elites. These men of substance, the commandants, Veldkornets, Friederrechters, Volksraadslieden, as well as the Landrosts, could operate pretty much on their own. The central institutions of government were disembodied forces in different places. The main products exported from the Free State in the mid-1850s were wool, livestock, ostrich feathers and skins from hunting, along with the odd bit of ivory from the remaining elephants, which were now almost totally shot out across the land. Living in the Caledon Valley and Orange River confluence areas were the Tlapping, a combination of Tswana peoples who had gathered in the area during the Difokane, loosely led by Adam Cook, but ostensibly under their chief Lepoy. French missionary Jean-Pierre Pelissier set up his station at a place called Bethuli, and by 1854, more than 3,000 Tswana, Tlapping and others lived there. They were a pretty mixed community. Escaped Rolong, Sotho, Tswana, and a number of bastards, as they were known, Khoikhoi, and freed slaves, and many of these had special skills. Ironically, many of the former slaves were literate, which made them influential members of the community. As time went on, this community became known as expert wagon drivers, transport riders, and wage laborers in the Cape Colony. But loaded onto many of these wagons was liquor. As the Boers settled their lands in the north and sold off their property in the Cape, they also brought up huge quantities of cheap Cape brandy. The locals loved it, preferring the heady dorp to their rather weak beers brewed from sorghum. Chief Lepoy began to hire out the springs on the outskirts of his territory to the Boers of the Sovereignty, then the Boers of the new Orange Free State. During the 1850s, pressure grew on the Tlapeng to sell their land. A booming wool market stimulated the demand for land, both speculative and for merino sheep agriculture. The Tlapeng will return to our tale a little later in the series, but it's important to keep them in mind as the Griqua-Boer-Sotho tension escalated. While the Bathuli area was fairly well defined, a big hurdle to long-term peace was the hazy border on the southeast side of the Free State. Which part of the Caledon was King Mushweshwe's land, and which part was the Boers? Mushweshwe had claimed the territory beyond the Caledon River, but this delineation had not been accepted by the Boers. The British left without sorting out the border dispute. A war was going to be the result. So here we have two freshly minted territories, Basutu Land and the Orange Free State, rooted more firmly in the consciousness through the emerging clarity of map-making, with a whole bunch of confusion over just where the border lay. Mushweshwe knew that being wedged between two Boer territories, the Free State and the Transvaal, was dangerous. He was also wedged to the east by the British in Natal. He wanted absolute independence for his people, and now that Sekhukhune had been defeated along with Maroka, Mushweshwe felt it a good time to approach the British and request one of their agents be appointed to live amongst his people. Local official Clark wrote a letter of support saying Mushweshwe ought not to be left alone, facing possible expansionism by Boer farmers along the Caledon. Times had changed back at the British ranch, however. It was only a decade before that Great Britain had annexed Natal, and here they were bending over backwards to avoid being drawn into more responsibility than was necessary. They cared about the southern African coast, particularly Cape Town, but what happened in the interior was of no immediate interest. Humanitarians in the British Parliament took issue with that political position, and some more conservative imperialists too. An empire was an empire. Why withdraw when it appeared to show weakness to their European opponents, like the Germans and the French? Head of the Colonial Office, Frederick Peel, was dragged before Parliament to answer questions about the Free State, and he wasn't glowing in his appraisal. Members had muttered that it was like handing Gibraltar back to the Spanish. There's a copy in the UK's Hansard about what he actually said about the Free State, and I quote, "Gibraltar, which was the pride of this country, the ornament of its power and the key of the Mediterranean, could not for a moment be put in comparison with the Orange River territory, which was valueless as an acquisition and was but a few years ago a mere desert." That was Peel. Quite insulting, really, to our friends in Bloemfontein. And 2 centuries later, British rugby players would regret that attitude when they ran into the significant rugby players from the desert. Back to our story. Inside the sprawling Free State land of 80,000 square kilometres lived 10,000 Boers and English, along with about 30,000 Griqua, Rolong and Tlapeng. While Hoffman focused on diplomacy, Treasurer Jacob Groenendaal and a 26-year-old Irish land surveyor called Joseph Orpin wrote the Free State's first constitution, and this was far more sophisticated than the Transvaal constitution, which was based on the Trekker 33-point manifesto, pretty much the Old Testament. Orpin had wanted the British to remain in the Free State too, but when they left, he accepted the status quo and became a founder member of the Volksraad, another example of how many Irish people have such deep roots in South African history. The architects of the Free State Constitution, a teacher and a land surveyor, produced a text that imposed no religious tests. It also featured the clear separation of powers and included a declaration of basic rights. What was even more important is that it had strict limitations on the powers of future assemblies to change the constitution, the fundamental law. As for the black population, they were separated from the white. Morocco's Rolong, we left in control of a tiny patch of land around Tabanchu, isolated from the farmers. As the Cape developed a colour, if not money-blind franchise, south of the Orange River, to the north, blacks would have none of the rights of citizenship for another 140 years. In the Cape, the growing density of farm settlement had led to the post of Surveyor General way back in 1826. This officer would oversee surveys within the colony, promote a trigonometrical survey, and then produce a map of the Cape and a possible beyond. Charles Cornwallis Michel, who was an energetic colonel of the Royal Engineers, set about his task. He also had a penchant for sketch and watercolour. Unfortunately, except for greedy speculators, he could not complete his task effectively. An enormous backlog of farm and town plot diagrams awaited approval, and by the mid-1830s, the task was deemed impossible for Michel and his two assistants. We know that the frustration over slow land registration was one of the reasons, along with rampant corruption and the fear of their culture being eclipsed, which contributed to the foot trekkers' decision to embark on the Great Trek out of the Cape. A major stumbling block was the complex mathematics needed to complete proper map making. The two British exams for surveyors were regarded as too tough, particularly the second exam, which involved complex maths which was required to correct previous erroneous surveys. Michel rewrote the curriculum, which contained sections on drafting and topographical drawing and plane trigonometry, with practical sessions using theodolites, a sextant and azimuth. These were the tools and skills of the trade, but this simplification came with a headache for later generations. They did not produce precisely scaled or geometrically accurate local charts. From the inception of surveyors early in the 19th century up until 1927, there remained a tug of war between the government and the artisanal surveyors until the Survey Act of 1927. Folks, when maps are bad, politics follow shortly after. Everything in the world is based on definition of space, so you can imagine the clashes and conflicts that broke out because the local surveyor got his numbers wrong. In the century before 1910's Union of South Africa, the demand for inspection of land and surveying created enormous growth in this skilled sector. In 1819, there were 17 sworn surveyors residing in the Cape. By 1860, there were 102. And between 1855 and 1859, 4 years, 31 were sworn in. They were trying to delineate a territory that was 500,000 square kilometres in size. All surveyors were white and male and educated. No blacks nor women. The people of the day thought surveying was too complex for non-whites and that women were, in their words, totally unsuitable. The surveyors appeared willing to reinforce both preconceptions and old boys' club elite. Close your eyes and conjure up a vision of the land surveyor, a virile white male Adonis astride his azimuth or theodolite, swinging the tripod around the countryside like a triple musket, perspiration dripping off his sunburnt schnoz as he took a swig from his hip flask. About 15% of these men swaggering about the African landscape were born in England and Germany and made their way to the Cape. The theodolite is a precision instrument used for measuring angles both horizontally and vertically. The contraption with its gleaming metal bits, a telescope, horizontal and vertical plates with their scales, spirit levels of glass filled with liquid in a bubble, its tripod base with screws, a plumb bob, swinging beneath like some ghastly gonad, clamping screws, focusing knobs, and vernier scales with their finely graduated tiny numbers, and a movable arm and a frame which attached to the telescope, an infernal machine. All it lacked was a grunting steam engine to complete its steampunkishness on the dusty felt. Dark arts were apparently required to operate this device. Mathematical wizardry, alien on the landscape. There were a few established and well-connected multi-generational surveying families, such as the Melvilles, the Greatheads, and the Watermeyers. They tied up the work in the land near Cape Town, so new arrivals settled in more remote districts. When the British seized the Cape from the Dutch in 1795, not a single proper map existed of any sort, at least none the British could get their hands on. In 1836, the Surveyor General of the Cape wrote that it was impossible to ascertain the real shape and size of the colony, because no survey having ever been made whereby either could be obtained. That which we see in maps is but a compilation of the notes of travellers. A guesswork, in other words. The collection which was more accurate was military, but they were of localized areas. In 1830, a Mr. Herbert was employed as a cartographer with a commission to compile a large manuscript map of southern Africa, which should be used as a base map for plotting all existing and new topographic information on an ongoing basis. It's referred to as Herbert's map and can be looked upon as the most authoritative map of South Africa of the 1830s, and it was then duly copied by British cartographer John Arrowsmith in 1850. There was also James Wild's 1844 map of South Africa. As one of the foremost cartographers of the 19th century, his map of South Africa had 6 subsequent editions that were published, providing a relatively accurate picture of the broad geographical knowledge of the time. One of the most important map makers was Irishman Henry Hall, born in Dublin, 1815. He arrived in the Cape in 1842 and served on the Eastern Cape frontier during the wars of 1846 and 1851-52, first in Grahamstown and later in Fort Beaufort. During his stay in South Africa, Hall contributed richly to the scientific and cultural life of mid-century Cape and drew a series of wonderful maps of the colony. As an engineer, he was actively involved in building the fortifications on the eastern frontier, and in later years he supervised the building of several public buildings in Cape Town, amongst which include the South African Museum and the National Library. The maps were improving, but the challenge was with local surveyors. They operated as a single surveyor with apprentice, supported by black workers. Before 1927's Act, they didn't have to produce a daily activity log, so our knowledge of their actions is patchy, to say the least. A dichotomy developed. The invisibility of surveyors on the landscapes, beyond their signatures on maps or diagrams or letters, was itself a necessary element of the objective pretense of scientific geography, a tendency for modesty, self-effacing, typically Victorian. It is ironic to note, then, many surveyors displayed a rather poor knowledge of the African landscape. They are trained using a European system. A tiny percentage spoke Dutch or African language, and this increased the perceptual distance between the swaggering macho land surveyor and the people living on the land. Their dark arts were indeed distrusted. Joseph Orpen in the Free State and Charles Lennox Stretch in British Kaffraria were two surveyors who were trusted because they lived in the same place for decades and developed a deep understanding of the immediate landscapes and its people. Perhaps we forget how important these folks were in our history. These blokes measured the land we live on today. The borders were set by these men. Some qualified later as justices of the peace because civil disputes over boundaries were some of the most common disputes of the day. Where does my farm end and yours begin remains a source of conflict across the world. They were so important that Joseph Orpen, and later his brother F.H.S. Orpen, ended up in the inner circles of colonial governments. John X. Merriman, who was to be the last Prime Minister of the Cape before Union in 1910, was a land surveyor. There's another tie-up here, a well-known connection between Victorian geographical science and African missionaries, such as David Livingstone, who could also use a sextant and a theodolite. On the frontiers and across the colony, the class of work that government land surveyors performed most was measuring land for purposes of title. This was not very rigorous, even on farms that were 6,000 acres. However, on larger maps, things began to go seriously wrong. The highly precise trigonometrical surveying necessary to fix absolute points on the Earth's surface, then construct a framework for consistent and accurate mapping, represented a stratospheric level of complexity, a mathematical rigor combined with astronomical work that was lacking. That was to change, but only in 1874, when the South African College, the future UCT, opened up a surveying program. There are many reports warning of how some of the undercooked surveyors overcooked their numbers. Gross mathematical errors in both individual and block measuring created disputes when surveyors' land overlapped. Some committed outright fraud, which lay undiscovered for years and sometimes decades. It was speed over accuracy. The more maps and diagrams they signed off, the more money they made. They were, in the main, paid by area, not per diem. Furthermore, this created what was called a fictional landscape of vacancy. This conveniently reinforced the disconnect between land and people amongst the administrators and magistrates, particularly in the Eastern Cape. And nowhere Was the potential for geographical confusion and unreliable surveying so great than in the heavily populated and contentious areas near the Kei River? Before the 1860s, geographical knowledge of the Kei and its tributaries was poor. By 1857, the Astronomer Royal at the Cape of Good Hope, Irish-born Thomas McClure, stated simply that any maps of Southern Africa at the Colonial Office were clearly misleading and unworthy of confidence. This created a land almost mythical in some ways. London authorities read descriptions of landscapes, particularly of the Kei. It was only in 1859 that an accurate geodetic chain was measured east of Cape Town up to the Kei River by Captain William Bailey, but he took until 1862 to complete his work, and that was only the coast. There was no accurate measurement inland. It was into this poorly mapped land that Governor Sir George Grey was going to deposit Crimean veterans. His idea was to build a series of communities along the frontier, mixing Amakosa and Europeans, where the recently deposited vets would then have families, and the youngsters of the families would meet Amakosa youngsters, hopefully at church, and a new sense of combined community would emerge, a kind of rainbow nation. Problem was, the scant 107 veterans of the Crimean and Xhosa Frontier War signed up for this Buffalo River Frontier Village plan. Most of these men were completely unsuitable for the job. To add to Grey's woes, lung sickness broke out, and Xhosa and settler cattle began dying of this virulent disease, made worse by the incubation period, which can be as long as 2 years. Tens of thousands of cattle died. Part of the Qunuqwebe's herd was almost wiped out. Grey's belief in a new British civilizing influence was unraveling before it raveled. Lung sickness was the final straw for the Amakosa, who were now ready to listen to any promise that could relieve the nation of their pain. Someone who could get their lost land back, someone who could lead them to Nirvana, the light, the promised land. A prophet or prophetess, Nonkawuse, the young girl from across the Kei River, was waiting in the wings. Oddly enough, there is a link between this mid-19th century youngster, Nonkawuse, and Russia. Because the Russians were at war with the British in the Crimea between 1853 and 1856, and the Amakosa were in conflict with the British. Not only was there sympathy for the Russians, excitement heightened as rumours of the Crimean War led to hopes that the Russians, who were believed to be another black tribe, would come to liberate their oppressed brothers and sisters. The Crimean War was an oddity, no question about it, pitting the Russian Empire against an alliance including the Ottoman Empire, the British, the French, and Sardinia Piedmont. The latter was eventually incorporated into the Kingdom of Italy in 1861. Back in sunny South Africa, when Nonkawuse began to have visions, all sorts of interesting caricatures would pop up in the mind of the teenager. It is not a stretch to correlate the Crimean conflict to the colonial struggle, at least in the minds of the chiefs in Southern Africa, and this thread continued through the Eastern Cape struggle movement into the 20th century. The historic tension between Great Britain and the Russian Empire, in its various iterations, continues to play out in South African politics today. We're galloping into 1856, and two incredible sagas await our edification, the Amakosa cattle killing and the AmaZulu civil war. Neither tale is for the squeamish. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. It helps elevate visibility, and you can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'm going to load updates about the episodes. You can also email me from there. Until next, goodbye.